Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush, winding out our Halloween, our Spooktober here with one last round table. If everyone wants to picture in their mind's eye a Zoom screen, a four banger is what we call these. To my top left, as I look at the screen, we have the winsome, lovely and charming Annie Reese, medium brownish blonde hair, friendly smile.
Thank you. I feel like we're describing characters in horror movies like who are going to be killed off one by one, but thank you.
You're the final girl, so you're in good shape.
Yes!
To the top right is me. I might as well describe myself. I'm wearing an Axl Rose bandana or a Rambo bandana, or Joe said Little Steven from Sopranos bandana because I did a spinning class before this and was dripping sweat, so that's why I look like a crazy person. Bottom left, I have former Movie Crush producer engineer Ramsey Yunt, but Ramsey left me like a bad cold. Ramsey's got a nice full beard. He's got kind of puffy morning hair, and he has a great t-shirt that says Atlanta wouldn't be shit without black people. Very much true.
Yep.
And then on the bottom right, we have Mr. Joseph McCormick. Joe always has bed hair, which in the best possible way, and sort of a scraggly little beard and mustache. And what does your shirt say, Joe?
It's much less profound. My shirt says Tom Atkins rules.
And who's Tom Atkins?
Well, Tom Atkins is the hunk from Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. He's the strawberry Burt Reynolds.
That's right. So we're going to be talking about Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. But I'm glad you're all here today, because you know what today is, guys.
No.
Three more days to Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Three more days to Halloween. Everybody, silver shamrock.
Did you sit bolt upright in bed in the middle of the night with that in your head?
So I had never seen that movie, you guys. We'll start with Halloween 3, sort of the non-sequel to the Halloween movies, and the story. Well, someone else tell the story. I talk all the time. Who wants to tell the story of why this is what it is?
Oh, Joe, I think you should go.
Yeah, Joe's sort of the
Halloween
expert.
Am I the one who spread this virus in the office?
Yes. Yeah. I'd never seen it until you were like, you pulled out this like fancy DVD copy.
Maybe too soon for spreading virus jokes, too.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Well, Halloween 3 Season of the Witch is the third entry, of course, in the Halloween franchise, but it does not have Michael Myers in it, the killer from the first two movies. It was fast.
It does very briefly.
Well, that's mm-hmm. true.
That's true.
Put a couple of different that. Times where characters in the movie watch the first Halloween on a TV, which is just wonderful. But it's the third movie, and they decided, you know what? What if we just completely started a brand new plot that had nothing to do with the other movies? The idea was that they were going to try to create an anthology series that would come out every year in October, and there'd be a new Halloween-themed movie. And, you know, so the director of Halloween 3, Tommy Lee Wallace, was from the John Carpenter scene. He was, I think, the editor of the first Halloween movie. And there were a lot of Halloween people involved in Halloween 3. One of the reasons I think it really feels on brand for Halloween, even though it's a totally different story, is that it has the Halloween 3, or it has the Halloween sound and the Halloween look. And the Halloween sound comes from a score by John Carpenter and I think Alan Howarth. And the Halloween look is definitely due to cinematography by Dean Cundey. And we should definitely come back to that, because I think that's one of the really great things about this ridiculous movie. do we need to describe the plot? The plot is basically that an evil druid warlock becomes a business tycoon who sells Halloween masks with the goal of distributing them across the country so that children put them on Halloween night while they watch a TV commercial that plays a jingle to the tune of London Bridge. And when that happens, their heads turn into crickets and they die. And this will appease the ancient Celtic gods.
Right, which is what you all feel like when you watch this movie and you hear that song.
Yeah.
It really has the desired effect, I think.
I think so, because I'm not spoiler, but I'd never seen either of these movies when I was like, let's do these. But I knew about them. And that song, like, by the end, like, not only was it annoying, but I was genuinely, like, tensing up. Like, please don't play that again. Please right? don't do it. So I think they accomplished what they were going for with that song.
Totally. Ramsey, what do you think about that song?
I mean, it definitely makes you feel uncomfortable, especially if you have kids that like to listen to nursery rhymes repeat repeatedly all the time. And like Joe said, they were strict on the budget, so they clearly couldn't afford to actually have someone write a jingle. So they looked into free licensing and, hey, there's London Bridge is falling down. And then, Tom Atkins actually did the voice and they sped it up.
And, really?
Yeah. And like, that's how they got that song. They thought it was so hilarious and it hit the point like of just driving that mono, like that, you know, that just the
seizure inducing.
Yes. That's the word I was looking for.
Oh, yeah. And it is paired with strobing visuals that.
That too.
This is not a good movie for somebody with photosensitive epilepsy.
No,
absolutely. But before we dive into the movie, just jumping back a second, Joe, I just want to say that I think it's a great idea to do. I mean, they were onto something with doing an anthologized Halloween thing. Just you could pump them out every single October with a new story. A really good idea from John Carpenter and his producing and writing partner, Deborah Hill. And I think some people feel like if this movie had not been called Halloween, it might have gotten a better shake.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not too sure. What do you think?
I would say almost all of the negative reviews you read from the time mention the fact that Michael Myers is not in it. And
okay.
So I think that clearly shows it was, you know, the reception of the film was colored by its lack of congruity with the movies that came before. People weren't quite getting why the third movie in the series was the beginning of a new anthology series.
Right.
On the other hand, I would say that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anybody would have paid attention to this movie if it was not a part of the Halloween series. But then again,
what about an alt title? Anyone got a good alternative title? Let's come up with one.
Well, they wanted to call it just Season of the Witch. I mean,
that was pretty good.
That was the thing. Like, they pushed, like, you know, after the first one, Carpenter wanted to make this an anthology, but the studio was like, no, we greenlit the second Halloween, and they fought, and then they made a second sequel to Halloween with Michael Myers, and then the third one, they were like, no, we're not going to do it unless we do what we want to do, which is the anthology. And they were like, okay, it still has to be called Halloween, though. And they wanted to remove that to separate it because they knew people are going to want to see Michael Myers.
And, getting stabby.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. Is like, that's why they went to see the first one and then the second one. And then they kind of felt let down going into the third one. I think it would have been okay just to call it Season of Witch, brought to you by the people that brought you Halloween. I mean, it would have still been.
That's a long title, Ramsey.
Well, you know, in the commercials, sure, and stuff like that. I mean.
Yeah. No, I agree. Season of the Witch. That's a good title.
I'd say for alt title, maybe Cyber Druids and the Mask of Doom.
That's pretty good. Do you got one, Annie?
No, but I have thoughts. One of the things I find really interesting about both the movies we're talking about today is I feel like they went on to define the franchise either for like failing or succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And this, like, I didn't realize Michael Myers, these villains become so iconic. And like, the first Halloween was an independent film that made $70 million. And people, you know, we almost are so willing to suspend our belief. Like, of course he's going to survive. He's going to get blown up, but he's going to live anyway. And so like when I was watching this, even I knowing he's not going to show up was waiting for him to show up just on how it's kind of shot. Mm-hmm. And like there's this sort of slasher vibe, but a slasher never really arrives.
Totally.
But it's just interesting to me that after this, that they're like, oh God, Michael Myers has to be in everyone now. And people were like, maybe he's an android. I like that theory that like, maybe that explains it. That's the reason the third one exists, is they introduced androids and druids. And perhaps that's why Michael Myers is what Michael Myers is.
Well, have we ever seen him bleed? Is it yellow goop? Is it yellow slime?
That's a good question.
I think we've seen him bleed and it looks like regular blood. You know how they did that
maybe
effect?
Maybe he's like a...
It was orange juice.
Yeah, it was frozen orange juice. So like when Dick Warlock... Really? Yeah, Dick Warlock... So the great stunt coordinator, Dick Warlock, is one of the main druid androids. His real name is Dick Warlock. He played Michael Myers. In Halloween 2, he was the Shape. And so in this movie, he's one of the main androids. He's the one who looks kind of like a blonde Paul McCartney. And he's often shown kind of like from the shoulders down, pulling somebody's head off or squeezing somebody's eyes out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And there's a scene where Tom Atkins kills this android by like plunging his fist into the android's guts and pulling the wires out. And all of that goop in the commentary track, Tommy Lee Wallace says they did that with frozen orange juice. So it was all over Dick Warlock's face in multiple scenes.
Well, that's good for a change. Usually it's just some nasty, like, you know, concoction that you don't want anywhere near your face. I'd take a little frozen OJ bath.
Refreshing. No
problem. Chuck, do you know what does movie goop usually taste like?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think usually it's just some sort of weird mixture that looks good on camera, but is, you know, like part oatmeal, part diatomaceous earth or something. I don't know. One thing I did want to mention is this movie, regardless of what you think about it, and by the way, I really did enjoy it. It had one of the great movie posters. I think it was even nominated but lost, whatever the movie poster body is that gives that award out. But it was nominated for Best Poster and really holds up. It's one of the great posters from that. Maybe one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful shots in the movie, which is Phoenix at dusk with those silhouetted children. Really, really gorgeous shot. Maybe the only gorgeous shot in the movie. Yeah. I mean, I like the cinematography, but it wasn't like beautiful or anything like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is a gorgeous shot, and it is a gorgeous poster. It gets to the idea that they were trying to create something that was tied explicitly to the season of Halloween, not just that happened to happen on Halloween like the first movie did, but that it's all about, you know, October and the autumn and trick-or-treating mm-hmm. and everything.
Well done. And they sold those masks for a while back in the day. Those are pretty cool. Like the witchy one or the ghoul or whatever goblin that is, that's a really good mask.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love the idea that they took Halloween, this holiday that we're all like, ooh, give me something scary. And they're like, let's make Halloween scary, like putting on your mask. Let's put in some capitalism is bad here. And
light sexual harassment.
Oh, yeah. You know,
smacking nurses on the butt.
Alcoholism apparent in the background. Like,
I like how whenever Tom Atkins had to do something, he had to have alcohol involved.
He had like,
yes, in every scene. He's drinking in every scene, and it's great. There are a lot of scenes that start where you don't realize he's got alcohol because he's holding it off camera, and then at some point he like lifts it into the frame.
Yeah.
And it was weird that they didn't pay that off or anything. It's just he's an alcoholic doctor, and there was never any – usually when you introduce that, there's some arc that the character goes through in regards to the alcoholism, but no. I guess maybe he was just like, hey, what if I was a drunk?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But never acted drunk or anything.
The female character, she shows up and he's at the bar and she's like, they told me I could find you here. And it's like the saddest bar you can imagine.
And the bar looks great. I want to go to that bar.
I miss bars.
No, you often get the sense that he was just having a few beers on set. And it's like he carried his beer from, you know, from off camera into
that
the scene.
He was having anyway.
He's like, you know, Tommy, I think my character would be having a beer in this scene. Okay, go with it.
Anybody got a brown bag with a bottle of vodka in it, perhaps?
That you'll share with a stranger who is then immediately announces his plan in front of the security cameras and is killed.
Yeah, that was pretty great. There were a lot of great scenes.
I want to share a piece of trivia about those masks in the movie that I came across, which is that the masks were made by a famous Halloween mask maker, Don Post Studios, who apparently made the William Shatner mask that was spray painted white and used for Michael Myers in the first movie.
Interesting. The great Don Post.
Yeah.
No, I think that was part of it is like he retained the license for these masks and was able to sell them as a promotional type of thing. And that's kind of how they got him to do it for this movie as well.
You know, I have a few questions throughout that Joe could probably answer that I was just a little confused about. And instead of rewinding over and over, I just figured I'd hold on to it. After near the beginning, after the slowest car smash into human in movie history, it's like, it's coming. Don't get up and move. Don't move. Stay there. No need. Comes a car. Here it comes.
It's like that scene in Austin Powers with the paver.
That's exactly what it's like. The agent, you know, I say agent. They look like agents from The Matrix. They come in and I can't tell what they do to that guy. It looks like do they gouge his eyes out? It looks like they pull his nose up.
Yeah.
Like it's a mask? Like, what's going on there?
It looks like a very brutal, blunt frontal lobotomy. Like, he reaches in through his eye sockets and then breaks off the front of his skull.
Okay. All right. Good enough.
There you go. Very extreme, I got your nose. Yeah.
Who's got your nose? I literally have your nose. And then that guy self-immolates, which is a pretty cool scene. Mm-hmm. But as far as I didn't know that the Halloween universe existed within this movie, and it was a real delight when you see the TV commercial come on referencing Michael Myers in the Halloween movie. That was kind of a nice little nod, I thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think they were trying really, 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 really hard to be like, this is not that. It exists in the same universe, but it's not that thing because see, it's a movie here. Like, that's what I loved that they did that, but that's what I thought, why I thought they did it.
I mean, you're right. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think they were tied so much to Halloween. I think for me, I mean, I enjoyed the movie. Don't get me wrong. It's fun to watch. But like, I think the biggest thing for me is they were tied so much to that and they were trying to separate themselves from Michael Myers. And there was a lot of production issues as far as the original screenwriter. He was a sci-fi screenwriter and he kind of made this evasion of a Body Snatchers type movie. Mm-hmm. Centered in like the caveat was he had to center it around Halloween or that universe that they wanted to continue, and then eventually left and wanted his name removed from the film because of his frustrations. So I think like a lot of that kind of hurt the film in regards it. And if they just, you know, like Season of the Witch, they mention witchcraft like maybe once or twice towards the end and you're like, where's the witches? Like, you know, that's kind of like if they had called it Season of the Druids, probably wouldn't have had the same type of ring to it. So, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I could feel like there's like a lot of things that were rushed and felt like they didn't take the time that they needed to. And they were kind of constrained around that barrier of Halloween. I mean, it would have been a great film, I think, even better if they had removed that aspect of it. But I understood what they were trying to do with that.
Joe, was there behind the scenes frustration as the resident expert on Halloween 3?
I mean, there was some, I think there was some of what Ramsey's talking about, like the disconnect between the expectation of, you know, of how it would fit into the franchise versus what the creators wanted to do. But at least listening to, like, I've listened to Tommy Lee Wallace, the director's commentary track on the movie, and it makes it sound like it was a lot of fun to make. I mean, it sounds like it was a very loose, freewheeling production process where everybody was just kind of like throwing ideas out there and having a good time.
Well, that's great. And I guess Tom Atkins was drunk the whole time.
Yeah.
My favorite is when he's on the phone And he, there's just a six pack sitting on the
table. Yeah. Like, it's behind his head. Yeah. He moves and then you see it.
I love that.
I didn't notice that part. What was that early on?
He's on a payphone with his ex-wife and he's like explaining why he can't pick the kids up. And then he finally moves and reveals there's a six pack of Miller, I think, that was behind his head the whole time.
He's like, I got to do doctor shit. You know, a bunch of doctors talking.
Yeah.
Well, she did make that one reference. She was said something about a drunk doctor.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be that he was. I didn't even realize that was a thing, but I picked up on it pretty quick. So,
I also love the fully Irish community in Northern California.
Yes. Yeah.
That, you know, I get they came in through Ellis Island and then said, let's travel, you know, 3,800 miles west and settle on the seaside north of San Francisco.
That was extremely strange.
I think, Annie and I actually watched this movie together a couple nights ago because I just wanted to experience it with her for her first time. And I think we said, like, the movie we really wanted to see is how they got a piece of Stonehenge.
Yeah, yes.
California.
Why did they get it? How did they get it there? I want the heist movie where they stole that.
It's gigantic.
You want the Rogue One version.
Yes. Yes.
It's the size of a shipping container. And you see there's a little hint about it at the beginning where a gas station attendant is watching TV and there's a news story about how one of the stones from Stonehenge has been stolen in the middle of the night. Yeah. Nobody knows where it went. And then you see it later. And of course, Dan O'Herlihy is turning it into microchips, like cyber druid magic microchips to melt people's heads.
That don't seem very well attached to these masks. Like they kind of fall off.
Yeah.
It looks like very easily removed.
The final process.
Yeah, the final
processing. Yeah.
Can't go in there.
It's a great band name, by the way.
Final processing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I kept questioning the actual plan here because they sold all these masks and I assume they want everybody dead. Mostly children, but then he's got his best salesman and he kills his like whole family. And I'm like, well, that's bullshit, man.
I'll show you.
Yeah.
He's been out hawking your goods.
That guy was great.
Yeah. He was so like pitch perfect.
Yeah.
I think that's horror plot pressures. I mean, there's always this need when you're making, especially kind of a lower level horror movie, to, you know, you get into the second act, you're like, I really need to be killing some people. So you've got to come up with some excuses to have characters die. Like one of the examples is, do you remember the plot with the lab technician, the lady who's looking into the car parts or the parts of the the druid android?
To her.
Yeah, he keeps Tom Atkins keeps calling her on the phone and then eventually she gets murdered out of nowhere with a drill. And it's like, why did that happen? Well, they just did that in a reshoot. They added that scene on where she gets murdered because they were like, not enough murders in the movie. We got to fill this out a bit.
Yeah. And like, how about a driller killer?
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not? Why not have these androids just use a drill to kill her?
The other thing we can't look past, too, is the great Stacey Nelkin as Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
And, the wonderful scene in the hotel room where they just start making out of nowhere. There's no hint of sexuality or tension or anything. Mm-hmm. And it's just on all of a sudden between like her and a guy who is old enough to be her father.
Yeah. I was outraged at this. And she's just like, oh, how old do you think I am? I'm old enough. And I'm like,
well, after they've had sex, he decides to check in on that.
It's actually worse than out of nowhere because I guess we actually didn't explain what was going on in the plot with the protagonists, which is Tom Atkins and Stacey Nelkin. He's a doctor. He becomes aware of this because somebody arrives at his hospital and gets killed by his druid android. And then she arrives to talk to him because she says, because the guy was her father. So she is trying to investigate what happened to her father. Like, why did her father get killed by a druid android? So they end up going to this town to like solve the mystery. And that's where they get it on. And it makes no sense at all.
Yeah, he's like a drunk doctor, and he's like, but I also dabble in private investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And her father, by the way, owned a small toy store. I'm very intrigued by this like anti-capitalist message in here.
I mean, it's really on point. You got the anti-capitalists, you got people like trying to put on masks and a bunch of stuff. It's pretty timely to where we are now. I mean,
yeah.
Well, except in this world, the masks kill Elon you. Musk. Elon Musk is a novelty gag make and mask maker. Like he's one of the richest men in the country with his fake vomit and whoopee cushion fortune. It's like, really? That guy is the richest? Like, that's who's making all the money in 1982 or whatever?
Well, I do think it's interesting that he's a tech tycoon, and it is set in Northern California. Santa Mira, the little town that it's in, is supposed to be, I don't know, somewhere outside of San Francisco. It actually,
yeah, it's north of San Francisco.
In reality, they shot it in a town called Loleda or Lolita. It's spelled like Lolita, but with an E. And it's somewhere in Humboldt County. I think the closest city of any size is Eureka.
And I think that's where they filmed Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
I love that movie so much. Yeah.
Yeah, that's up in like Birds, Alfred Hitchcock's Birds zone, too. Sort of that north of San Francisco, or maybe that was south, but all up there. Another one of my favorite funny, great scenes is that I just classify as no one's ever done this before at all, is when she gets out of the shower with this, I guess, too small of a towel and with a fully wet body, just pulls the nasty top comforter off the motel bed that no one ever uses and just wraps herself in it. I guess because she's freezing cold. It was weird. I saw that and I was like, no one has ever done that in history. Who has ever done that? Gotten out of the shower and been like, oh, let me wrap up in this top comforter.
Yeah. I mean, the characters make a lot of choices where I was like, huh. Like when they first arrive at the hotel and the Irish owner is like, let me show you your room. And he runs off, like Tom Atkins runs off without like questioning anything immediately, and it's like investigating behind his desk. Like,
yeah,
it's just they're an interesting team.
Well, the other weird thing too was like they just decide to spend the night. Remember, they didn't even have luggage or anything.
Yeah,
yet but she has a nightie and lingerie. It's like, where did that come from?
Yeah, and she's like, it would be weird if we didn't stay the night. And I'm like, I guess.
Oh, so many questions, you guys.
Yeah. I mean, this whole town in general, like you come in and there's surveillance cameras and there's a curfew at 6 p.m. And I do love that Connell Cochran apparently has cracked androids and is using it for this purpose. Like,
to kill the children?
Yeah. Yeah, he's figured out like how to steal Stonehenge, druid killing spell, and microchips and androids, and is just keeping that to himself. Yeah.
And how to conjure snakes and bugs from thin air. Where do they come from?
No one knows.
Do you have an answer for that?
No, I mean, it's just Stonehenge magic, man. It's all Stonehenge.
Stonehenge magic.
It was creepy, though.
We didn't say this, actually, or maybe we did. Anyway, Connell Cochran, the evil warlock, entrepreneur, whatever, the guy who makes the masks and the androids, is played
by Dick Warlock's dad.
Right. Yes. He is son of Cochran. He is played by Dan O'Herlihy, who is the old man from RoboCop. The guy in RoboCop who is like Ronnie Cox's boss, when Ed 209 shoots that guy until he is liquid, he says, I'm very disappointed in you, Dick.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Another one of my favorite lines is when they take the tour with the family of the top salesman or whatever, and then they see the dad's car sort of covered up, and they get back to the hotel. Mm-hmm. And I had to rewind this a couple of times to see if he said what I thought he said. But he said, I think it's time for the Marines. I think it's time to send in the Marines. And then he walks it back to police. I was like, did he say police? And I was like, no, he said Marines.
It's an unmentioned fact. He's also a Marine colonel.
Oh, is it really?
No, not at all.
Man, God, you just made my day for like half a second.
You know, there could be that actor could have had a whole plot in his mind. We don't know.
Yeah, that's true. His backstory.
Mm-hmm. Who are we to say?
But with the snakes, though, and I mean, this movie isn't super scary. It's a lot of fun to watch, but That the scene in the fake living room when they kill off the family was pretty chilling. And those snakes and bugs, and combined with the audio of that goddamn song and the lights, like, that was kind of the one part of the movie where I was like, make this stop.
Yeah. Like I said, I feel like this is very 80s conspiracy thriller vibe more than horror slasher. But that was the one part where I was like, that song, it legitimately unsettled me by the end. I was like, there are TV screens everywhere. You can't escape this. This song is going to kill me. I told Ramsey, I'm like, I'm afraid I'm going to wake up in the middle of the night and I'm just going to have that song and that's the end. I also, the scene where the other toy store owner, where her face like gets blown out by a lightsaber, that was pretty that was gruesome. I don't know if it was scary, but that was a good kill in these.
Yeah, good makeup work.
Yeah. Excellent.
Well, Tommy Lee Wallace says, you know, when he's trying to explain what he was going for in the movie, he keeps saying, you know, I think the thing that's really the scariest of all is Big Brother and corporate bad guys. And he keeps talking about how these are the themes he was trying to bring out in the movie. It's scarier than any monster is the corporation that's watching you with cameras and everything. And that is throughout the movie. There's constantly cameras zooming in on people. And I don't know how much that would come through as the real theme of it. Did you guys pick up on that?
Yeah, I did.
Annie was all over it.
Yeah, absolutely I was. But I don't know. I did a terrible thing and researched it before I watched it. So I don't know if I would have, if I hadn't known that was kind of a vibe of like capitalism, cameras everywhere watching you. I'm not sure. But I did, going in with that mindset, I absolutely did.
This movie was a lot of things, you know. It was that, it had this sort of Wicker Man culty vibe because of the town. Mm-hmm. It was also androids and had like this sci-fi bent. It was a mix, a lot of things mixed in a big Halloween trick-or-treating bag.
Yes.
I mean, you look at like John Carpenter's work in general, I mean, you know, with Escape from New York before this and all the other movies he has done. I mean, it has that fear of corporations and taking over and military police and that type of stuff. So I could easily see that when you're watching this one, you can feel that in there as well.
Did he and Deborah Hill, they didn't write it, did they, or did they? Oh, no. You said the other guy wrote it.
Carpenter, he took some, he did as well.
He did a pass. He did a pass on the script.
Yep. Yeah. And then they brought in a third writer to kind of horrify it up a bit. And I think that's where the sci-fi writer was like, it's out of my wheelhouse now, guys. And I don't want to be part of this anymore.
It has the feel of something that eight people wrote.
It does. It does.
Another one of my favorite parts, funny parts, was on the elevator when the robot, you know, basically goes, achoo. And Cochran looks back and goes, convincing, eh? And I'm like, no, not at all convincing. That was the most canned fake sneeze, robotic android sneeze I've ever heard in my life, actually.
I remember, I mean, there's some movies that people can warn you about and tell you what it's like, and you just can't know until you watch it.
Yeah, you got to see it.
And this was one. And that scene, I was like, what is happening here?
Well, Chuck, since you brought up convincing, my favorite sequence was when Tom Atkins throws the mask onto the camera.
Dude.
Yes.
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 From his waist, because his hands are tied.
Yes. I mean, that's impressive. I say, my theory is he's been to a lot of like tailgating events. He clearly drinks a lot.
Yeah.
And he knows how to play some cornhole. He knows how to play these types of games. He's been, maybe that's the payoff. We just never really appreciated it.
Get him to the county fair, man. He's going to be walking out with like the giant bear.
Yes.
It's amazing.
That took them like 50 takes to accomplish.
That was one of my favorite shots in the movie. It was just fantastic.
Yes.
It looks like they shot it with the mask on and falling off and just ran it in reverse or something, because it just kind of went.
Well, the director threw it on. He's like, how hard can this be? And he got it the first time. And then they went to shoot it. And like, they did it like 50 times after that.
Right. Yeah.
A day well spent, I say.
I have here, the mask throw over camera is the best thing in the whole movie.
I mean, it actually, I think, is emblematic of what's so good about the movie, which is it's all texture. I mean, all the things that I love about Halloween 3 are not really the contents of the plot. I mean, it is sort of pleasingly zany and disjointed and in a way that's fun. But what really works about the movie is the look and feel of it. It's almost like, you know, a video game that feels good to play. It's a movie that feels good to watch. And I think a lot of that, like I already said, is the sound. It's that texture of the John Carpenter score, and it's the Dean Cundey look with those great, you know, really good use of the anamorphic widescreen, filling the whole shot with interesting stuff. A lot of those great still shots of environments and all that. And the fact that, I mean, it's so texture driven. The movie is almost like rubbing a fur, you know, except it's a fur that's kind of like got orange juice goop in it, or it's like it's rubbing a mustache. It's rubbing Tom Atkins, Burt Reynolds mustache,
which I was like, is this real? Is this a fake mustache?
Right. It's dipped in vodka. Another couple of funny things. They have cameras like in every inch of this town, yet somehow the doctor is able to sneak into the main control room and like reach his little hand up and start just typing a bunch of buttons.
Yes.
Oh, geez. When they're walking, they have that little, like, I don't know, the rack of masks, and they're trying to get across. And he's hiding behind.
It turns into a Three Stooges episode. And then, I mean, I don't know how he knew how to do all that or what effect dumping those things out would have, but it had the exact right effect, such that Cochran gives him a little golf clap. Like, yes. Well done, sir. You have foiled me.
Alas, my empire ruined.
So funny.
Yes.
And then, you know, the end, this movie might break the record for the most times a dead body comes back to life. You know, great horror trope. But yeah. Ellie comes back to life, I think, two or three times.
Maybe four.
Yeah.
Including the hand. I mean, you got to include all those.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
So. Question. I want to go around, actually. Was she a robot the whole time, or was she transformed into or replaced by a robot at some point?
Hey, don't you Blade Runner me, pal. I think she was replaced. That's what she was doing on that operating table. That's what I think.
Okay. Yeah.
I think so, too, but it would be an interesting twist if, like,
sure,
the daughter of this independent toy store was taken. And like, I don't know.
Oh, it would be like the Wicker Man. Like, she's the Rowan Morrison that draws the police inspector to the town. She was just sent out as a cyborg to bring Tom Atkins there, except it wouldn't make sense because they don't end up.
Alcoholic doctor. Yeah,
they don't burn him. He defeats them all. So I don't know.
Well, we don't know, do we? Because it ends. Like, there's still possibly one commercial that might play.
Yeah, I mean, it does have a dark ending. He, you know, it's playing out on TV. He gets on the phone, I guess, with the CEO of television.
And, convinces him.
He just speed dials it. It's like, you run television, right? Sure. Yeah. Get this commercial off instantly. All right. Like, it was that easy.
Yeah. Well, so many things in this movie he seemed to accomplish that he should not have been able to accomplish, whether it's the mask on the camera, or I was like, how does he know what to type on this odd keyboard thing? He figured that out. Now he's got the number for whoever he needs to talk to and convinces them to take off one, two runs of the commercials, but maybe not the third. I don't know. Like, I wasn't expecting that ending. I will say that. I didn't know it was going to end there.
Yeah, I mean, it's dark. The idea, I guess the notion is that one of those commercials ran and whatever kids were watching that turned into snakeheads.
Yeah.
Well, and that's an interesting thing, too, is that, you know, that's one of the cardinal rules of horror movies is you don't kill children. And this movie was like, meh.
Let's kill all the children.
Millions, millions of children are just crickets now.
Yeah.
I think that's a good choice. In his review, Vincent Canby of the New York Times, I think, said that the movie was... It simultaneously managed to be anti-children, anti-capitalism, anti-television, and anti-Irish.
Yeah. One of those good old-fashioned anti-Irish movies.
Yeah.
Well, I also enjoyed, like Ramsey pointed out, you know, Stonehenge is in England. I like how it was Irish, you know, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
They went that way.
That's a very good point, Ramsey. Why is the Stonehenge an Irish thing?
I have no idea, man. They're
maybe
just lucky,
it was
I guess.
Payback. They were mad at the England take their Stonehenge, use it for killing people for reasons unknown.
Oh, it's like
American American children.
Yeah, do it in California.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the Simpsons episode with the lemon tree, you know, like England is Shelbyville.
Oh, yes.
Look at that.
Yes. You got to have your rival, rival country, town, whatever.
Oh, I love it. Can we move on to Dream Warriors? Are we ready?
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
All right, so Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, a movie that I don't think saw, although there were parts of it where I was like, wait a minute, have I seen this? It definitely, like young Patricia Arquette definitely rang a bell, the only good actor in the movie, which is, I always wonder what happens like literally on set where you have like one really good actor and surrounded by a bunch of buffoons, like what is going on in Patricia Arquette's head? I know she was young and it was kind of a first movie, but she's good in this and went on to be a really great actor, I think. But
Lawrence Fishburne,
I saw it or not?
Lawrence Fishburne's good.
Lawrence Fishburne, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, of course.
And I feel like Robert Englund. Maybe I don't know if he's a good actor, but he's good at that. He's good yes. at what he does.
You're also bringing back John Saxon as well. So I mean.
Who's he? Is that Nancy's dad?
That's Nancy's dad, yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of nice to see him pop up. And Nancy, God bless her. What's her name?
Heather Langenkamp.
The
epitome of likable on screen, but yeah. not good at acting.
Not good at acting at all, but just somehow perfect for this still. Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. It's sort of a magic trick, I think.
I love that she showed up. I hadn't seen this. Ramsey and I watched this last night. It's my first time. I love that she showed up and she was sort of like, you know, it doesn't really make sense that she's this hotshot nightmare expert. but I like that she did. And she was like, you know what? We're going to be warriors. We're going to fight this guy in our dreams. I loved it. Get it, Nancy? It's his final girl in the first one. And she's, you know, come back. She didn't go away. I liked it.
one thing I really love about all the nightmare movies that I've seen, which isn't that many, is... just the dreamscapes always are so cool looking, like, and they don't hold up in terms of like modern filmmaking, I guess, but they still have a great, like really creepy appeal. And the, I just think it was a brilliant concept to have, the devil be in your sleep. Because every movie, it's like it's a really stressful thing to be fighting sleep like that.
Yeah.
And you know, as soon as one of these kids goes to sleep, all hell is going to break loose. And it is, I don't know, it just holds up. It was a pretty brilliant concept from the beginning, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that, like, there's that creepy thing, too, of it never really, there's usually not a scene where you're like, oh, they're asleep. It's like, oh, okay, now there's no scene where like their eyes close and you're convinced they're asleep.
They keep you guessing, which is one of the little, you know, they go back to it over and over, but it works every time somehow.
It does.
I would say it also, it works at a symbolic level. I mean, not to get too cheesy or reading too much into Nightmare on Elm Street movies, but I think it's significant in these movies that the adults and the institutions are always telling the young people to just go back to sleep. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. Just shut your eyes and lay down. And it's the kids who are trying to remain alert and remain aware. Something seemed kind of politically significant about that.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, it is definitely a great movie of its time. I mean, if you look at everything else that was happening and what movies were coming out, I mean, you had Heathers, you had all the John Hughes movies and all these other things where there's all a lot of teen angst and, you know, teen suicide was, you know, sorry to use this, but like a buzz as far as trying to prevent suicide within teens. And, you know, that was like the focus of that. So the filmmakers looked at what was going on and the movies that are coming out and was like, how can we capitalize on this and make an 80s movie where we can bring teenagers and film, you know, people that just love what we're doing here. And then, you know, that's kind of how they focused this movie, you know, and, you know, it was their version of the Breakfast Club in a way, and so to speak. So, yeah.
Yeah,
no, totally.
I think it's interesting too, like, if you go deep and you look in horror movies, and I know we've talked about how they represent like our fears as society, but also like, this whole concept of why didn't you believe somebody? And I think a lot of times in horror movies, women aren't believed are marginalized, people aren't believed. And in this movie, you have like the aspect of mental illness that they've all been by Freddy is pinned them all into this mental institution where people just don't believe them.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying that you could be like, no, there really is somebody trying to kill me. And nobody believes you. Nobody really cares. It's scary.
I totally agree. Speaking of the dreamscapes, another thing I love about the nightmare movies is just how fucked up they are.
Yeah.
I mean, they really go for mainstream movie making. These movies go to places that you only see usually in like, you know, super B horror movies. Really disturbing imagery, whether it's the
vein puppet.
Poor little Joey, you know, when he finally gets to make out with the nurse who is clearly like a Playboy playmate in disguise, and their tongues latch onto each other, and then he's tied up with the tongues, or the scene with the fucking needle fingers in those what is that in her arms? Those little mouths?
They're little mouths.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's just so fucked up for mainstream movie making.
Yeah. Roger Ebert actually wanted to, like, he, with his review, he said this movie should be rated X. Like, he was like, this is so fucked up. Like, I don't know how they could give this a rated R. Like, he was just really adamant. He was like, this is one of the most scariest things, and teenagers are going to watch it. And I actually saw this in the theater when it came out. A friend of mine, because I was like around 10 years old or so, and we snuck in and saw it. Because, like, I had seen one and two, and I was like, I was already obsessed by like with horror films, and I like snuck in, and it freaking scared the shit out of me. And, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's freaking frightening, all the stuff they came up with. And, you know, my favorite kill, well, one of them was the puppetry, the puppet thing. Like, that great. Is just such a freaking horrible scene. I mean, but it's, and like the special effects though, I mean, this, they threw so much money, all the budget basically went to the special effects, and there was a lot of it was all practical, except for like the animatronic or the stop motion Ray Harryhausen type thing with a skeleton at the end.
Yeah, that scene.
Yeah, but it was like, they just threw so much money at the special effects, and
they ran out clearly at a certain point.
Oh man,
I like the Jason and the Argonaut style stop motion, but it looked like they shot it in front of a bed sheet, like projecting the movie. But they probably did, actually.
Yeah. My thing is, like, when we were watching it last night, I was like, why did they dig a six-foot grave for, like, bones? Like, they could have just dug a little hole and threw it in there. It would have saved them hours of digging a hole.
That's definitely true.
But then where would the tension be with that, Ramsey?
Yeah.
That's
very true. Yeah.
Joe, what's your history here with this movie? Are you a big Nightmare fan, or?
You know, I've seen all the Nightmare movies as a general horror fan. It's never been like my key franchise. I remember thinking this was one of the better ones in the series, and going back on it now, it has its ups and downs, but I really do love a lot. I mean, you were kind of knocking some of the sets and the effects, but I have great affection for the way this movie looks. The sets and the effects, I think, are a lot of what gives it its charm. I love the Freddy snakehead puppet, and I mean, even some of the grossest parts. Ramsey, you were mentioning the part with the vein puppet, you know, where the arteries are pulled out and they're the strings. I mean, that's just one of the grossest images I've ever seen, but it is haunting. It's really quite astounding what they accomplish there. And one of the things that I think is interesting is charting the evolution of Freddy along the course of the series, because in the first movie, there are a couple of little moments where Freddy has some kind of fun or personality, but mostly he's just this nasty, frightening, obscure figure of darkness. And that's mostly true through the second one as well. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on in the second one. That's a whole other can of worms. But by the third movie, Freddy's starting to settle into what he would become for the rest of the series, which is more of a comedian. Like, he's starting to have more personality, to make jokes, to kind of mug for the camera. And I think that with a character like Freddy, that kind of thing is sort of inevitable as the series progresses, because I don't know. I mean, you see like what diminishing returns there are with Michael Myers in the later Halloween movies, where it's a killer who doesn't talk and just continues to walk around stabbing people in movies that are basically the same but worse over and over. With Freddie, they changed things by making him a comedian, and I don't know what else you could have really done with him.
Yeah, I mean, he scared me when I was younger because for those reasons. He ran at people, and you know, I think we were sort of conditioned to Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees stalking very slowly, not speaking. Freddie's running like a crazy person. They're always so creative with what he can do with his, like, the knives turning into different things like needles. Mm-hmm. It's sort of still really upsetting. And especially now that I have a daughter, when he's always calling girls the B word, it's like, yeah, it really doesn't sit well with me to like hear him screaming that at these like high school girls. It's really effective in how disturbing it is, I think.
Yeah. I think I brought it up last year when we did one of these roundtables. Like, I saw Robert Englund do a talk at Dragon Con, and he said that he would go into this one as everything, like, his kill lines were mainly improv. Like, you know, are you ready for prime time, bitch? Like, that was all improv in there. But he would do a straight one where he would just kill them and talk, like, no talking, no puns, nothing like that. And then he's like, hey, let me try this. And then he would do his pun. And they love that. And they're like, okay, how can we expand this character? And that's why you saw like the introduction of his backstory. They started to fluff it out a little bit. And then, you know, how can we connect people? And I think like for me, Freddy was always, he stood out differently because I had nightmares as a kid. So that like I could connect to that. Like I not necessarily had nightmares about Freddy Krueger, but I had things that haunted me in my dreams.
So because you were seeing these movies at 10 years old, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, no, like with that, my folks were just like, you know, whatever, you know, you're going to watch whatever you want to watch. And they try to hide stuff. Well, they were interested into it too. My parents, like, they didn't watch Nightmare on Elm Street, but they watched, you know, I remember sneaking into my parents' room while they were watching Jaws. Like, I hid underneath like a couch or something or just to watch it. It was just that fascination. So then I was afraid to go in the water anyway. But like, but anyway, like I was saying, it was like, you know, I was always afraid of Freddy, but like Robert Englund's like, he would add those puns, and then him being able to talk to his victims and have that interaction was different and not something we saw in slasher flicks, like your Michael Myers and, you know, even like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and stuff like that outside of, you know, with Leatherface and stuff.
Yeah. The other thing that's so scary about Freddy is that, and it ties back into the he comes in your dreams is that means there is no safe space. Like you can be the cops can get you and like put you in a jail cell and have and surround you with cops with guns. But it doesn't matter. Like there is no safe space because you're eventually going to fall asleep. And that's really just sort of it gives the whole franchise an unsettling feeling, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they like sedated Patricia Arquette's character, I was like outraged, like she doesn't want to be sedated. Yeah. They're like, no, we're gonna sedate her, and like just taking away that agency and putting her in like this very dangerous, frightening situation.
Yeah, no good. Even though when she finally got her Gymkata on,
yes,
Gymkata. I love that scene where they all have their superpowers and
yes,
who's the one
Kincaid
guy? Oh, Roland. When Roland is just like, I can bend these chair legs. And the doctor's like, well, stop doing that.
There's a wizard.
Like, I love the wizard.
Apparently there's a video game and like you can choose what superpower you want to fight Freddy in your dreams.
Yeah.
So I take that. I'm into it.
Where is the, I have it written down here. Oh shoot. I had the best line in the movie from Roland when he calls him up. Oh, here it is. Yo, Freddy, where are you hiding at, you burnt face pussy?
it was pussy.
So yeah. Great. It's time to stop guessing and start messing.
You know, Freddy's like up to the ante with these puns. You've gotta bring it.
Yeah, I like Roland a lot. He was pretty great when he just busts through that wall.
Wait, did y'all get the meme I made and sent you the other day when I found out that the director, Chuck Russell, who made this movie, also made Jim Carrey's The Mask?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And as soon as I found that out, I was like, whoa, the similarities. I mean, Jim Carrey as the mask is very Freddy Krueger in a way. He's like a, you know, a non-murdering Freddy Krueger.
Somebody stop me.
Well, so I was thinking because he's all burned, you know, smoking.
Yeah.
For me, like when you bring up Chuck Russell, like a lot of these early horror movies, like you have John Sayles that wrote like Piranha, and you have other filmmakers like Frank Darabont was the writer on this, and obviously he did like Walking
really?
Dead. Yeah. And you got Angelo, sorry if I mispronounce this, Badalamenti, who did like the score for Twin Peaks and a lot of David Lynch films. I mean, these were people getting their start, and so they would go into a production and be like, who's hot right now? Who do we like? Who do we think can make a good movie? And then for our budget, and they basically brought them all together. And like a lot of the, you know, the puns and developing Freddy as a character came from these talented filmmakers and in where they, you know, where they got their start from. I mean, pulling no punches, you know, for this.
Yeah. I mean, this movie did really well. It kind of, breathe new life into the franchise after I think Nightmare 2 was, I think, a bit of a disappointment. Mm-hmm. And then Dream Warriors came back in 87 with that great metal soundtrack.
And
it had all the elements. You know, it was funny. It was really gruesome and fucked up. Some good cheesy acting, good soundtrack. It really had all the pieces.
Yeah. This was a make or break movie for New Line. I mean, they just threw everything they had at this just to see if they could get it to work, and it obviously did. I mean, this, and then a couple of years later, they did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was also an independent film that made over $200 million with a shoestring budget as well. So, I mean, they were really talented at the beginning getting these things going and making them profitable for independent filmmakers.
Yeah. New Line is called The House That Freddy Built.
oh, nice.
And I do think the similarities between these two movies, it's interesting because they were movies that decided where these franchises would go. Freddy became kind of what Freddy is in this one, and having these iconic villains that people just go back for more and more. But Freddy is different in that he does talk and he does make puns, and he moves quickly and he's in your dreams. I think it's interesting to compare. Also, like, we've got this sort of mediocre doctor in both of them that has, like, is it very memorable? Sorry, Tom Atkins.
Craig Wasson. He was in, what I know him from is the great Brian De Palma film Body Double.
Oh.
But he's quite an overactor. He has one of the better lines in the movie when he refuses to give them the drug to keep them from dreaming.
Hypnosil.
And he says, dream deprivation is a serious thing. And I'm like, is it?
Well, when? To be fair, I think maybe that's not known. Like there could be bad medical effects to not dreaming. I think maybe we don't fully understand that. I want to be fair to this film.
All right, Joe.
Yeah, let's be fair. I like it. I also like how he has like a serious pivot where he goes from like, You're not making sense, Nancy, to, oh my God, Nancy, I care about you. Let me talk to your dad. I can convince him to do this thing that you couldn't do. Like, there's some whiplash for me in that arc for him. And then also, like, you know, the whole nun thing, and now there's like a religious element to Freddy and like a crucifix. Like, I get why they did it, but it was kind of weird. I feel like Freddy is above religion.
Yeah, I mean, it implies he's a demon if holy water works on him, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing is like, what is it? He's the rape, like, 100 people? I don't know. Yeah. Interesting twist.
Freddy Krueger did not need that backstory,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think so.
she was one of the great creepy nuns.
Mm-hmm. You gotta have a great creepy nun. That's true.
I mean, that was kind of cool. And you know, Nancy coming back to save the day as a sort of a class C Ripley or Sarah Connor, class D. But she kind of played that role. But you know, if you're a fan of the franchise, to see her and her dad come back, and I guess that her dad was a cop in the first one, and he's been downgraded to security guard, right?
Well, he's also an alcoholic, I suppose.
That's right. Yep. He's at the bar that opened up on that great mullet head playing pool. Don't tell me you didn't notice that guy.
Yeah. Right away, just focus in.
He's just squared up in the frame, like immediately. And they're like, is he going to say action? Is he going to say action?
Both of these movies have great depressing wood panel bars.
I thought it was the same bar.
Yes. It's, yeah. Wouldn't
I love
that
those kind of bars.
That these two movies exist in the same universe.
Yeah, you just pan over and there's Tom Atkins.
Well, oh, and then, I mean, there's Freddy versus Jason. So I guess Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th.
I haven't seen any of those later movies. You know, I mean, I don't know if you remember last year when we did roundtables. My horror stuff was fairly limited because I was sort of into it, but not really. And I never had like the good, because I was a little church boy. I never had a friend like Ramsey who was like, you got to see this stuff, man. It's batshit crazy. So no one was like feeding me these movies. So I saw the big, big ones, but like, I don't think I saw past Friday the 13th 3 even.
Oh, Chuck, let us be your bad friend.
Yes, please. I pitched that you should have a segment where we do bad movies. Fun bad movies.
Here comes Joe, 3, 2, 1, Jason X.
And, is that the one?
Oh, well, I mean, there are a lot of... So I actually prefer watching the later movies in the Friday the 13th series. Obviously, if you're looking for one that's actually a good movie, I think the first one is the best. But later in the series, they get very bad, but very fun. Just like the most watchable kind of bad slasher movie is like the whole run of 5 through 8 is just glorious.
When is Crispin Glover dancing? Which one is that one?
Oh, that's 4. Actually, 4 is really good, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Glover does this amazing...
You got a franchise that was sued by the city of New York because...
Yes, I love that.
They put it into the promotion when Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yeah, that's a movie, Chuck. Jason Takes Manhattan, and there's a scene where he's in front of a TGI Fridays, and that's so good.
Well, next year, we'll get the same group together next year for a roundtable, and maybe we'll just like... do the best bad Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I will say, to bring it back to Nightmare on Elm Street, there's a big difference between Jason and Freddy, which is that Jason murders people, but he does not come off as a bad person. He comes off as kind of a force of nature, or almost like a machine without a mind that's just sort of making the murders happen. Freddy Krueger comes off as a bad person, and that's a big difference. He comes off as aggressive and evil.
That's a good point, because we were talking about this last night, where I'm like, you know, in the new one, the twist is he actually did do the thing that they burned him for. But in this, like, originally he didn't do it, but was burned, killed.
So you're supposed to have empathy for him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but because he does take such seeming pleasure out of killing... Instead of, I don't know, being more of a force of nature or just like this is vengeance. Yeah, but it's like vengeance, but like vengeance with super relish on these children who didn't have anything to do with it. It's been so long since I've seen the following movies. Like, does he just start killing people who aren't connected to what happened in the first one?
Well, sorry, guys. So you see the scene where he just like grabs the souls, like he takes his shirt off and you see all the faces on his chest. So basically he's collecting the souls of all the children. And so where the series goes after this is, you know, Nancy dies and, you know, Patricia Arquette character, she's now the hero that we follow. And then the next movie, they basically, within the first 5 minutes, kill off all the Elm Street kids, which are the kids whose parents killed Freddy Krueger. And in that process, she transfers her knowledge and power to another Alice, to another person. And then you follow her for another couple of the movies. And then I think they just run out of material. And basically, I think she survives. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the movies that well. But like, so it follows her. So once that
Patricia
happens,
Arquette's in the one after this?
No, she did not. She was one and done.
She dies immediately, I suppose.
Yeah, so her replacement dies immediately along with Kincaid and Joey. They, you know, like Kincaid's poor like, Joey. If you want to go see my movie, don't go any grab popcorn because I die in the first 5 minutes. A dog comes named Jason and pisses on Freddy's skeleton and it comes back to life and kills Kincaid.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that the truth?
Yeah. Wow. And they were like, how do we bring him back? And basically a dog rips his leg and pisses on it and pisses and rehydrates fire. And like flesh comes back onto the bones and comes back and kills Kincaid.
Wow.
And then, you know, then they go kills Joey and then, you know. Yeah, so that's where the progression goes with the how they're able to continue the kills. And then the next two, like the next four and five, you start to see the wane of the special effects, but like they push that special effects into the fourth one. So it's worth the watch because it's all practical. It's not digital and CGI and stuff like that, which I think kind of killed the series as far as an enjoyability and stuff like that. As, just for me, you know, just growing up. We have to talk about Dokken.
Yeah.
I mean, the record went platinum. That song went platinum. I mean,
did it really?
Yeah. Like,
does anybody want to do a little chorus?
I think we'd all have to do it together, wouldn't we?
No.
1, 2. We're the Dream Warriors. Wait, are we gonna get night cheese for that? Is that? Do we have to cut that out,
like,
or we get
you
sued?
You sing that? And Freddie comes. It's like Bloody Mary for Freddie. Now you guys are haunted. I didn't do it, so I'm good.
Well, we need to get in here is Joey, because apparently he has super voice. I mean, is that his superpower? He yells no, and that's what does it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like Banshee.
A little anticlimactic. Yeah, it's sort of like Banshee.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the thing was, you know, all the reasons why they were in the mental institution became their superpowers, which was sort of an interesting message.
Yeah, I think so.
He was too traumatized to speak. And so at the end, he finds his voice. It's loud enough to scare Freddie away.
Yeah, I get it, Annie.
Let me explain more to you, Chuck, how you should have interpreted this film, excellent film.
But we can't not mention Fairy Dad at the end.
Oh, jeez.
When Fairy Dad comes down,
Sheriff Elvin.
It's amazing.
Nancy's like immediately buys it. I was, you know, this is obviously Freddie, but she's like, oh, Dad is passing over. I've loved you always. And then it's Freddie. Like, yeah. But her dad is actually dead.
Pretty great.
Yeah.
So I think before we go, guys, if you've got another like 10 minutes, maybe we can each mention one other thing that we've watched this Halloween that maybe you've never seen before, if that has happened. I'll go first while you're thinking. I've watched a couple of movies last week. I watched one called Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which is this very kind of cult classic from the early 70s. That is really, really pretty good. I recommend it. It's streaming on Criterion app if you've got that. But very much a cult classic, not a huge movie. Very creepy and in the perfect sort of early 70s horror way. And then last night, after watching Dream Warriors, I watched the remake of Maniac with Elijah Wood.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen that movie?
Yeah. Yeah. That movie. Oh, my gosh.
Nope. Did not like it. I mean, it was effective, but it was really disturbing in like not good ways. Not like, oh, but that was good. It was disturbing in how they treated mental illness. It's disturbing in how they, you know, it's a first person perspective. And the scenes where he's stalking these women from the first person was really fucking disturbing. Some of the grossest shit I've seen. It was just, I don't know, might be some people's cup of tea, but I was very turned off. Like, I had this face.
Yeah.
Like, throughout the entire movie, my face was just twisted and screwed up because I was like, why? Why? So, do not recommend.
That movie messed me up. Like, I had the same feeling. Like, I will never watch that movie again.
Yeah.
Because the original was also messed up, but it doesn't go that far.
Yeah. It was pretty bad. I mean, not bad, as it was well made, and I see what they were doing, but just not for me.
Yeah.
Joe, have you seen anything new this October?
Oh, I was trying to think.
Or have you been diving into the classics?
Oh, I've been watching a lot of the classics. In terms of something I saw that was new that was kind of bad and good in an interesting way, it's an early 2000s movie. It came out maybe like 2003 or 4 called Cursed or Cursed. That I think was directed by Wes Craven, since we're on Craven right now. Mm-hmm. Written by Kevin Williamson, the guy who did Scream and Dawson's Creek and I Know What You Did Last Summer. And it is I can't say it's a good movie. It is definitely bad, but it's an imminently watchable bad movie. I would say I was never once bored, though it really does not make any sense. And for people who are interested in how movies get made, it's a notorious case of studio interference, studio creative interference that just kept coming in and requiring rewrites and reshoots. I think they made the movie basically three times. And what you ended up with is not a coherent product at all, but is also very interesting and entertaining.
All right. Cursed. Annie, what about you?
Well, first I want to give one last Nightmare on Elm Street fact that I owe Ramsey for. All is right. That Robert Englund was roommates with Mark Hamill and helped him get Star Wars. What? My very first crush. Yes. Okay, that's a story I want to see. For new, I
Robert Englund is Han Solo.
Mark and Bob.
I was like, what? Roommates.
Well, no, I think Mark Hamill was sleeping on his couch or something, and he was like, I got this audition. I don't know if I want to do it or not. I'm in my soap operas. It's some space movie. He's like, no, do it. Go do it. Do it.
Are you ready for prime time?
May the force be with you.
Oh, God. I want Freddy Star Wars puns so badly. I recently watched The Other Lamb, which was touted as like a more feminist version of Midsommar, which is kind of a heavy label like going in, but I really liked it. And it's about a cult where the leader is like sexy Jesus, but everyone else is women. And he has sex with the women, but not on their periods, because like I said last time, I'm all about menstruation supernatural horror right now. Yeah, and so it follows their little journey of realizing maybe this guy not so good. Maybe we should like kill him. And then I watched this movie. I can't really remember what it was called. It was like Tell Me a Story or something. It was on AMC. But that I enjoyed it. It's basically about like two writers. One is a young woman who's really successful. One is like a middle-aged man who's like super not successful. And they get trapped in a cabin together. And they tell each other stories. And the interesting thing about that movie, it's one of those movies where I couldn't tell if the writer got it or not. Because the whole message at the end was like, I mean, spoiler, but he's a really bad dude. And he's like, I'll tell you a very scary story. It's about a man who's a failure and a woman who just has everything. And I'm like, I can't tell if you're making a commentary or like actually mad about like a woman who's been more successful than you. I don't know, but I enjoyed it. It's worth a watch.
All right. Ramsey?
I haven't really watched anything new. I have been watching horror movies, but I haven't watched like, oh, let me give that a shot. But I would like to say like I went back and revisited the, I guess the newest Thing movie.
Is that any good?
It wasn't it wasn't as good as the John Carpenter version.
Of course.
And so like, but it was still enjoyable. And then I went right into John Carpenter's Thing, and there's actually, it's pretty almost seamless how they did that. It still has the same feel as Carpenter's and all that. And they bring a lot of that elements in there. And, you know, I was kind of disappointed when I heard it was coming out, just like, come on guys, let's do something new, that type of stuff. Yeah. But it was a good surprise. And another surprise was a movie called Ready or Not, which I think is streaming now on HBO Max. That one was actually, you know, was pretty good as well. It's kind of like a campy, you know, cheesy horror type of elements and stuff like that. And a lot of fun stuff in there. But I think those are the two that really have stood out, you know. I recommend that both of those. I mean, there's definitely a break from the news cycle and all that type of stuff going on.
Nice. Well, this was a lot of fun, everybody. This is going to come out Friday, one more day to Halloween. So everyone have a safe Halloween. It was good to see Annie a lot, but good seeing you, Ramsey. Good seeing you, Joe.
Yep.
Likewise.
And, everyone loves these roundtables. It's maybe we should stretch these into November at some point. I don't know. That just seems wrong, but these Halloween shows are a lot of fun for us.
I think yes. There's a Thanksgiving yes. horror movie with
oh yeah, Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
You haven't seen Thanksgiving?
Oh goodness me, Annie Reese.
I've seen a lot of bad horror movies, you guys.
That's great.
Isn't there one with a killer turkey too?
Yeah, that's Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay.
Jeez, Joe.
Obviously.
All right, everyone out there in podcast land, have a great Halloween weekend. Stay safe and check out Halloween 3 Season of the Witch and Nightmare on Elm Street 3 Dream Warriors. Both very, very fun movies. One a little scarier than the other, but Halloween 3 is pretty great. Highly recommended, right?
Yes. Rub the fur.
All right. Bye, everybody. Rub that fur.
Bye.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown. Edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson. And scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponce de Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.